Next on this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, we discover the magic of vodou with priestess Sally Ann Glassman.
In Haiti, there's a great deal of animal sacrifice that goes on, and it's within a cultural context that makes sense, and a whole community, after a ceremony has concluded, will eat the food, so it's helping the whole community to survive.
Then, Marianne Winkowski shares recipes of the dearly departed from the Ghost Whisperers cookbook.
This woman was so happy that you had me here to release her that she gave you her secret nut roll recipe. Would you like it?
Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers coming up next. But first, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Barbara Klein. After months of political instability in the Czech Republic, 2 days of parliamentary elections have failed to produce a final outcome. The left-leaning Social Democrats appear to have picked up 21% of the vote, more than any other single party, but as the BBC's Rob Cameron reports, not enough to form a government.
After 7 years in opposition, the Social Democrats were counting on a resounding victory. Instead, this result, just over 20%, could spell trouble for them and more instability for the Czech Republic. The real winner of this election is Andrej Babiš, a food and fertilizer billionaire whose ANO party clinched second place. He could now be the kingmaker, as the Social Democrats are forced to revise their plans. The parties of the former centre-right coalition did poorly after years of corruption scandals that have left Czechs disillusioned and even disgusted with their politicians.
The BBC's Rob Cameron. Dozens of women in Saudi Arabia say they're driving cars today to protest against the kingdom's religious ban on female drivers. As NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Riyadh, the women got behind the wheel despite government warnings.
The drive to end Saudi Arabia's unique ban kicked off early on Saturday when the first video was posted online of a woman driving in the capital. Activists have been officially warned of arrest and possible legal action. Some high-profile organizers got personal calls from the Ministry of the Interior advising them to stay off the road. They were also shadowed by undercover cops and what appeared to be an intimidation campaign. However, the warnings have been mostly ignored. Support to lift the ban has come from surprising quarters, including male commentators in Saudi's mainstream media. Deborah Amos, NPR News, Riyadh.
For those with old, expired prescription drugs in the medicine cabinet, today was a chance to dispose of them safely. NPR's Sam Sanders reports on Prescription Drug Take-Back Day, a free and anonymous government program with thousands of drop-off sites around the country.
The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration promotes the Drug Take-Back Day as a way to dispose of old prescriptions safely. It's also a chance to raise awareness of prescription drug abuse. The DEA says almost 7 million people abuse prescription drugs in America, and most of those abused drugs are obtained from family and friends. At a drop-off site in Culver City, California, DEA agent Sam Peng said any drugs his staff receives are locked up and then burned.
They're escorted down to an incinerator where we'll dispose of them in a much more environmentally safe manner than if they were disposed in the sewer or flushed down the toilet in the garbage.
The event is held twice a year. The last 6 drug takebacks have brought in 2.8 million pounds of pills. Sam Sanders, NPR News.
This is NPR. In southeast India, tens of thousands of people have fled their villages after torrential rain caused extensive flooding. But transportation is difficult with roads blocked and rail travel halted, and crops are destroyed in the area known as India's Rice Bowl. Iran's state-owned Fars news agency is reporting authorities have hanged 16 militants. An official is quoted as saying it's retaliation for the rebels allegedly killing 14 border guards last night near Iran's frontier with Pakistan. Iran's deputy interior minister says the attack was an ambush by Iranians who belong to hostile groups. At a border crossing between Syria and Iraq, Kurdish fighters have beat back hardline Islamist rebels after 3 days of clashes. Tim Fitzsimmons reports.
Kurdish fighters took the border crossing into Iraq from al-Qaeda-linked groups early Saturday. The Yarobia border crossing in eastern Syria had been controlled for months by an Islamist group believed to be supported by insurgents in Iraq. Kurdish militias control swaths of northeastern Syria, and they have clashed with rebels throughout Syria's civil war. Some Kurdish groups are pushing to form their own autonomous region, similar to the one that exists in northern Iraq. On Friday, the Syrian government claimed that it killed Abu Muhammad al-Julani, the leader of Jabhat al-Nusra, though the hardline rebel group claims he is still alive. For NPR News, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons in Beirut.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo says he's launching the country's first state-based gasoline reserve. It's aimed at preventing gaps in supplies during severe weather, like the ones that crippled areas after Superstorm Sandy. A pilot program is being set up on Long Island. The reserve is expected to hold 3 million gallons of fuel. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org.
Hola, habla Diego Martín Pérez de San Juan, Puerto Rico. Les vengo a decir que yo escucho y apoyo a KRBS porque con programas como Espacio Latino y La Bellonera están esforzándose en representar la comunidad latina presente en la región sur de Luisiana a través de la música y la cultura. Por favor, únanse a mí en el apoyo de KRBS durante su campaña de recaudación de fondos en su 50 aniversario en la radio de la región de Acadiana.
You're listening to KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, a public service of the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Find us on Facebook at KRVS Public Media.
Y'all, Chef John Fulce welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. From the swamps and bayous of South Louisiana, thanks for joining us in our little piece of culinary heaven where good cooking is just a way of life. Mornings begin here with a roux simmering in a cast iron pot, and our evenings end with thoughts of what we're going to cook tomorrow. All right, everybody, welcome to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio, and we thank you so much for joining us at the kitchen table today. It's so nice to have all of you with us, and I want to begin by welcoming Michelle York, our executive producer, and what's all those trinkets you have in front of you there?
These are my vampire teeth.
Yeah.
These are my vampire teeth, and we have
Slama,
a set for everybody.
Slama. She's got packages here of little trinkets. What's that, vampire teeth? What is
These
that?
Are vampire teeth, and we even have a bloody bite.
Oh, blood bites. Oh, they got a little package of red. You know, why not think about this?
As an entrepreneur
I am, I should have thought about this. So you're getting ready for the big day coming up.
Well,
what,
absolutely.
Next Thursday,
we got to get into the spirit of things.
Yeah, right.
Just saying.
Slama, how you doing today?
It's a little scary, I have to say. Spooky.
You know, we had a girl at St. James High School when I was...
The talk of the school.
Well, yeah, I was kind of the thing on campus, so to speak. You know,
yeah.
I mean, everybody wanted to be a part of this scene, so to speak. But anyway, there was a girl there who was... I won't mention her name because I'm sure she's an avid fan. But you can always count on holidays, or especially these days like Halloween, that... She would be so excited about the day is coming up. I mean, she'd be running around the school making sure everybody was, did you put up a sign? Or are you going to dress like a goblin? Like you had to throw cold water on them. Because Michelle is like that. You see how that
1,000%.
Just because they were fangs today. So anyway, it's great to have both of you here.
Well, good. Thank you. Nice to see you as well.
Yeah, no. Well,
you're going to wear
so
your fangs?
I don't know. Think so. I don't think about wearing fangs because I normally have them normally.
Well, I wasn't gonna mention that.
Well, you know, y'all, I did enjoy Halloween as a kid. Well, I have to say I didn't dress as a chef. I dressed as a chef now, and I didn't dress as a chef.
Yeah, he's always in costume.
Yeah.
You know, I had somebody call one time to arrange a cooking demo for you. And I said, and do you think that Chef Fulce could wear his costume?
His costume.
Well, of course he can wear his costume.
Slam, I was on Capitol Hill in Washington a while back speaking before one of the committees up there. It was funny because the chairman of this committee said, I'd like to ask Chef Fulce, by the way, just to clarify for the committee, is Chef your first name?
And I said, yes, it is. Thank you so very much. He said, well, I found it very strange because he said, I saw that it was Chef John Falls, and everybody from the committee's chairs up here is saying, chef. So I just wanted to clarify for the committee that that is your first name. I said, yes, it is.
Yes, sir.
And I'm under oath.
Oh, no. Getting everyone in trouble.
Very few people address me less than chef, right? But anyway, you know, I didn't always dress up, but, you know, we had a cook. She was so much more than a cook. She was a mother. But Mary Fascio would send me out around this time of year and always say things like, Johnny Fo, go get me something to put in my gumbo pot out there, you know. So that's kind of, I think, when I decided that I should probably be dressing up as a chef the rest of my life. So not Halloween, but I should be dressing up as a chef.
So
it started out, I guess, having something to do with the big day, right?
I see. Well, you know, Halloween, because I am excited about the occasion.
We know.
The origins actually date back to the time of the Celts and the Gaelic culture. You know, November 1st was actually their date for the new year. So there was a celebration for the end of summer and the harvest season. And on the night before November 1st, superstition had it that the dead would return to wreak havoc on the living.
And they would.
And damage the crops. So in order to fend them off, the Celts would light bonfires and sacrifice animals to their deities. They wore costumes with animal heads and skins and dressed as ghosts so that the returning spirits would get confused and think that they were one of them. The first Halloween.
I could see that, too. I mean, you could see them, right, all with animal heads on.
Sounds like actually maybe a little wilder than they do today.
Well, that's where Mardi Gras must have got his tradition. Anyway, y'all, well, along with honoring their deities, superstitions and fears play, such a large part in the early festivities and through the centuries that Halloween celebrations have gone through many, many different phases over the years. About 1000 A.D., the Celtic Druid pagan celebrations were replaced by Christian commemorations of the holy days of All Saints Day, All Souls Day, as we know it today. These fell on the 1st and 2nd of November, making October the 31st the Holy Eve, called All Hallows Eve, and of course, eventually, Halloween.
You know, in the early New England colonies, Halloween, it kind of became secularized. There were parties and festivities and dancing and ghost stories and even fortune telling, which is kind of hard to believe in the New England colonies considering the whole Salem witch trial and everything. But anyway, here in Louisiana, we still, you mentioned All Saints Day, we still celebrate that, scrub the graves, whitewash the tombs, bring flowers to our departed loved ones. Halloween is actually involved into much more of a, I guess you would say, a community-oriented event today. There are neighborhood parties, town parades, dances. A lot of people in neighborhoods get together. They cook on Halloween and, you know, everybody shares in trick-or-treat, which is actually a recent phenomenon.
I didn't know that it was recent.
Well, compared to the ancient roots of Halloween, it is. It actually didn't get its start until about the 1930s. But it was in 1952 when Walt Disney made it a part of American culture because Donald Duck, in one of the cartoons, had trick-or-treat.
No, I did not know that.
It's a trick-or-treat cartoon. See, when you were celebrating Halloween
in 1930.
No. When you were a kid, because you were right on the edge. You were hip.
As always.
Cutting edge of
cutting
Halloween.
Edge, yes.
I just wish I was.
Hence the fangs.
Anyway, y'all, the movie Dracula with Bela Lugosi, remember that movie, did come out in the early 30s, popularizing that vampire count. You know, I'm sure that probably accounts for the plethora of black cape little tricksters that come. I don't know if they come to your house and ring the doorbell and they bring spray paint, you know. Spray paint. Trick or treat with us.
That's what you did. You were the black cape little trickster. In fact, I think today you're just a white cape little trickster.
I give them anything they want when some of the 12-year-olds have sledgehammers.
Oh, boy.
I'm just kidding. I mean, they're well supervised, much better than we were when we were raiding all the orange trees You know what I mean? So I appreciate those. But anyway, no doubt about it. I mean, the celebration is exciting for kids and well-organized today.
You mentioned Bela Lugosi's Dracula. You know, it was only very loosely related to the book that Bram Stoker wrote, Dracula. And of course, Stoker's book is said to be based on the historic figure, Prince Vlad Dracul Tepes, known as Vlad the Impaler of Transylvania.
Well, either one of those two names would be easy to remember. Prince Vlad Dracul Tepes, or better known as the Impaler of Transylvania.
His name. The Impaler, yeah.
Well, we remember it today. He was called the Impaler because of his standard method of execution. He would impale his enemies on stakes, and it's estimated that he actually put to death 40,000 to 100,000 of his enemies. He ruled in Romania in the 15th century during the three decades of the Ottoman conquest of the Balkans. He actually sided with Pope Pius II in the Crusades against the Turkish sultans. And needless to say, he was eventually assassinated. Well, yeah, I wonder if he was impaled.
Yeah, I'm hoping so. But I do remember scenes in history books or in where you could see that sight of people impaled by him. I mean, it was pretty unbelievable. You know, talking about the, siding with Pope Pius and the Crusades, during the wars he fought, Vlad was captured and imprisoned at the famous medieval Bran castle that still stands today on the cliffs overlooking the Bran Gorge, a passage through the
Carpathian Mountains.
Have you been there?
Not yet, but I'm planning a trip.
Are you?
Yes.
Since Romania is now open to travelers, thank God, you can tour the region and the gorgeous countryside and, of course, those beautiful mountains looming in the background. That'd be a great trip. I wonder if we could tie a culinary trip into that. It's got to be great. I mean, Romanian cuisine, right? That's on the Danube River.
I'm ready. No. I'm ready. You know, there are actually Dracula tours, but we could do our own.
Well, it looks like we're having them today. The locals are ready for us, too. Some enterprising folks there seem to have gotten wind of the obsession with vampires in the story of Prince Vlad and have capitalized on this. There's a tour called the Dracula Tour, which claims to give tourists the story of the real Count Dracula taking a bite out of the myths that we've heard for so many years. You can travel to Bucharest, Transylvania, through the beautiful, pristine countryside and mountain passes. You can tour the Bran Castle and visit the medieval sexton towns that were victim to the onslaughts of this guy. Cobblestone streets, beautiful fortress towers that you can just imagine what they look like. Castles and even the Palace of Parliament, a remnant of the communist regime, are all on these tours. But the vampires, where you got to kind of run into them yourself late at night on the street. I don't think they supply those.
You know, I don't usually give a preview of our guest, but he's going to be so interesting to speak with. He actually wrote an article entitled Eternal Terrain, Transylvania. And I just have to read this to you because it just sets the scene for the conversation we'll have with him. He opens the article, "Just north of Bucharest, I left this century behind, and an hour later, the last one fell by the wayside, too. As I slowed the car to turn onto a dusty country road, a farmer in blue overalls stopped pitchforking freshly scythed hay just long enough to give a wave, and the hunty scent of linden flowers wafted in through the open car windows."
Wow.
Isn't that awesome?
Well, I'm marking my calendar, y'all, right now. I'm going to pack some cast iron pots, Michelle, and I think we ought
to cast iron cauldron.
Yeah, I think we ought to do a little after the hunt, or maybe call after the vampire or something like that. Look, I'm up to it.
Take
anyway.
A bite out of Transylvania.
Okay, Dean, we're going to take a little break right now. Keep us on track, and we have a great guest that I know our listeners will be talking about. He's written a book on this subject, so we'll see y'all back in a minute.
It's so creepy, this world is so creepy. Trick or treating can leave me so empty. Summer is over and now it's October. You're getting closer and I'm saying no sorry. Monsters and they all
but you can't scare me and you can't defeat me.
Hello, this is Mariusz Smoly, music director and conductor of the Acadiana Symphony Orchestra. I support KRVS because it provides the perfect balance between in-depth informations on the world affairs, things that are important for our community, culture, and the world music. Please join me in supporting KRVS during the 50th anniversary fundraiser.
Glide through your weekday mornings at 11 a.m. here on the Medicine Ball Caravan. I'm Cecil Doyle. Mondays through Thursdays, we cruise through a fast-paced hour of sounds, both old and new, as well as keeping you up to date with area music and arts. The Medicine Ball Caravan, 11 to noon weekdays, here on KRVS.
It's the little old lady from Transylvania.
I'm the little old lady from Transylvania. I'm known from London to Pennsylvania. I drive Sir Jackson through the
mud. Michelle, we have a great, great guest on our show today. We're talking about things we love here, and of course, travel being one of them. And as we were talking a little earlier, some of those areas, Romania, and, and I was telling you about my trip to Bulgaria and driving through those mountains and getting to these little bitty towns that have just stood there for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's just absolutely incredible reading some of this, some of our guest writings. I could relive a little bit of it. But, go ahead and introduce our
well,
guest.
Well, I was reading a few excerpts from the article that he wrote, Eternal Terrain, Transylvania for Savour Magazine. But our guest, I want to let everybody know, is a James Beard Award winner. He's an author, a food commentator extraordinaire, Alexander Lobrano. He's been writing about food for quite some time, actually. He was the European correspondent for Gourmet magazine for 10 years, from 1999 until it closed in 2009. He's also a contributor for food and travel articles for Bon Appetit, Food and Wine, Travel and Leisure, all the big boys, Condé Nast Traveler, Departures, and, of course, other publications. He's also the author of that wonderful book, Hungry for Paris.
Oh, what a great draw.
I know.
I couldn't put the thing down. Being in Paris as much as we have and then going through his book, I said, why didn't I have this before, right?
Well, you know, the good news is next time we go to Paris, we have a friend. We have a friend in Paris.
Yeah, but you know what happens when we call on our friends in other countries when we get there? They say, now, who are you again? You know?
That's why you have to be on your best behavior today.
Okay, good, good. I will.
You know, he's got a second book coming out next spring, Hungry for France. So very excited about that.
Oh, I can't wait for that.
He was awarded the International Association of Culinary Professionals Burt Green Award for his Spirit of the Bistro article in Savour.
Yeah, ASAP, right, Jim?
And of course, as I mentioned, that's where I found the great article that he wrote on Transylvania. And I should mention that we actually tried to get Alec. You know, we're on a first name basis now.
Yeah, right. That's just because you're trying to see him in Paris and get a free tour. So you want to believe your friends already, right? You got to earn friendship, Michelle.
I'm working on it. Alec couldn't be with us last year for Halloween because, alas, he was on his way to Vietnam. I mean, somebody's got to do it, right, Alec?
I'm always happy to hop in a plane. No question.
You sound exactly like us. We always jumping on a plane going somewhere. And I said, Michelle, where are we going? Where are we off to now?
But, Alec, you're actually away from your home base of France right now. You're stateside with us in New York.
I just got into New York yesterday. I had to come back and see Rizzoli, the publisher who's bringing out Hungry for France in April. And they wanted me to come back and go through the galleys with them before they're shipped to the printer. And then I also have to go in to Random House, my other publisher, the company that brought out Hungry for Paris, and I've just finished an update of Hungry for Paris that'll be coming out at the same time as Hungry for France.
Oh, wow.
No sooner than that was turned in than they want to get me busy again. So, you know, Life is good.
Life is good.
I'm getting ready to say, when you write books of the quality that we've had, Hunger for Paris, and then, of course, your writings in general, there's always room for you, I'm sure, in publishers' offices. No doubt about
well,
that.
Well, thank you, Chef. That's very kind.
No, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I remember carrying your book around because Michelle and I have done quite a few trips that way. We're fortunate to be one of the Alliance members of I have a culinary school at Nicholls State University outside of New Orleans, where we have about 400 culinary students, and we have an alliance with the Bocuse School in Lyon. So it has us traveling there every now and then, but also
not often enough.
Well, not often enough.
It's a wonderful city, Lyon, and that's a terrific school.
And I had the mayor in my restaurant Revolution in New Orleans just a couple of days ago, and I had the senator from that region of Lyon in, and we had a wonderful, wonderful lunch as we talked about France and about Brest and about all the things in the region. But anyway, that's getting off of the subject. We just love your work and just absolutely love what you're doing. So thanks so much again for being with us.
Well, thank you.
Are you going to have time to come see us in Louisiana since you're stateside? Can't you make a little detour? You get to ride a
plane.
Well,
you know, that's a big ambition for 2014, actually, because I have, on my father's side of the family, I have very old Louisiana roots, and I haven't been down for a while. And as I often tell friends in New York City, it's a big country on the other side of the Hudson River, and there's a lot of great stuff there. So I'm planning to come down sometime in 2014. I still have family, a lot of family all over the place in Mississippi and in Louisiana, and I miss the food.
What is the connection to Louisiana? That's very interesting, in the South in general.
Well, my great-great-grandfather, who I think was something of a rogue, was born on an island off the coast of, right in the Bay of Naples, and he went to sea when he was a boy, and he ended up in the Gulf of Mexico, and somehow or another found his way, became part of Lafitte's band.
Oh, wow.
The pirates.
Sure.
And long story short, after the War of 1812, when the pirates helped the Americans defeat the British, they were pardoned for their bad deeds and allowed to become respectable citizens. So at the end of his life, he married a French lady and had five sons, and ended up, from what I've read, he liked to eat, so I think that there must be something genetic all these centuries later.
Well, let me assure you that when you do have a chance in 2014 to come our way, we would love to be able to host you here in New Orleans. We have a beautiful restaurant company there, Royal Sonesta Hotel, right on Bourbon and Bienville, in the heart of Jean Lafitte country, right next to the old Abstinence House, where Jean Lafitte and all of his band of privateers, let's call them, hung out. So anyway, it's a sincere offer, so make sure you put us on your first phone call prior to coming our way. We'd love
to
set some things up.
Absolutely, and I look forward to it.
And we're good.
So, Alec, you travel, as we mentioned, I mean, you do travel extensively. What is it that brought you to Transylvania? I mean, was that a story that was assigned to you, or was that just kind of a long, lifelong ambition to go there?
Well, I wish I could say, I think like a lot of Americans, I was dimly aware of Transylvania, and that was Dracula, of course, but the way that it came about is that right after the Berlin Wall fell and they started running trains again, the famous Orient Express train from Istanbul to Venice, I was invited on the first trip from Istanbul to Venice, and that train went through Turkey and then Bulgaria, and then we jotted up into Romania, about which I knew very little. And we spent a night in Bucharest, and the following day, it was a long day in the train looking out the window, and all of a sudden, I saw some of the most beautiful countryside I'd ever seen in my entire life. I mean, just storybook beautiful villages and pastures and mountains and forests. And I wondered where I was. So the first thing I did when we finally got in for the night was get out a map to try and figure out where we'd been. And I realized that we'd been in Transylvania. And it fascinated me because, again, beyond the folkloric association of Dracula with Transylvania, the countryside was so magnificent. So several years later, I suggested doing a story on Transylvania. I had read that the Prince Charles in England had bought a house in a Transylvanian village, and that a lot of people were undertaking to restore some of these abandoned villages in Transylvania, and that you could rent houses in the villages. So the idea of that particular article was that I would become a householder for a couple of weeks. in a Transylvanian village and explore their food ways.
You know, you mentioned in your article that region seemed to be locked in this just real fascinating but fragile time warp. And certainly I hadn't been there, but being in that region after the fall of communism and just kind of seeing some of these little villages, when I was traveling through Bulgaria doing some research on cheese and some of the fetas and the different types of cheeses we wanted to get involved with here in Louisiana, I found the same thing. I found that these villages not only were just locked in this fascinating time warp. Tell us a little bit about your impressions being there and what was that fragile nature of it? What did it seem like to you?
Well, the thing that I should explain, Transylvania, there are three major ethnic groups in Transylvania. There are Romanians, of course, but there are also a large number of Hungarians who still speak Hungarian to this day. And then there were people that are referred to as the Saxons. And the Saxons were brought into the area in the 17th century when it was part of the Hungarian Empire and the Hungarians were fighting the Turks. So the Hungarians wanted to colonize or populate the frontier between the Turkish Empire and their empire, and they recruited these hardworking German farmers to till this incredibly rich land. And that was something else that fascinated me when I looked out the window, because a lot of the villages looked like something you might see in the Rhineland or in Luxembourg or, you know, all through Central Europe. They're very Germanic-looking, incredibly tidy. And these villages, because they were frontier villages, were fortified, and the farms were set up almost sort of like shapes of pie. They were medieval machines for food self-sufficiency. So you had the house on the main road, and then the land expanded behind with pig pens and chicken coops and vegetable gardens and beehives, and at the very back of the piece of property, orchards. And the basic idea was is that everybody who lived in the village produced absolutely everything that they ate. I mean, they raised pigs and made their own charcuterie and chickens and fruit and all the rest of it. And when I first visited the region, a lot of the Saxon villages had been abandoned because Ceausescu, the Romanian dictator who was overthrown after the Berlin Wall fell, needed money. So he struck a deal with the German government, and he allowed the German ancestry descendants of these villages to repatriate to Germany for a couple hundred euros a head. So many of these villages had been abandoned, and that was why Prince Charles became involved, because he felt that this was just a remarkable pre-World War I slice of European countryside that was sort of miraculously intact, and he felt that something should be done to preserve both the architecture, the rural ecology of this unindustrialized countryside, and also its food and culture. And I think that one thing that still would surprise people if they visited this part of Romania, Transylvania, is that many Americans think of Romania as a Slavic country. We tend to look at Central Europe and we think of it as Slavic. Romania isn't a Slavic country. It was settled originally as part of the Roman Empire. It's a Latin country in the Romanian language, which I certainly don't speak, but was surprised to be able to sort of vaguely understand, because I speak French and Italian. It's a language of Latin roots. So there are layers of food culture there. There's the Latin layer, which was whatever the Romans brought in. And then there's a huge Turkish influence, because this Transylvania was on the frontier. Parts of it were part of the Turkish Empire for a while. So the cooking is spicier there than it is in other places in Central Europe. And then, of course, the Germans, as you say, they brought their traditions, especially the traditions of great pork butchery and a different spice palette than you find elsewhere in Romania.
You also mentioned that some of the wines and a brandy in particular that you tasted in someone's home while you were there, you mentioned it was a homemade caraway brandy, which sounds very unique. So, and I also read about your sampling a Transylvanian Riesling, which John and I both love Riesling, but can't say we've ever had one from Transylvania.
Someone was telling me the other day that they're going to start bringing more Romanian wine into the U.S. The vineyards as was true everywhere in the Eastern Bloc, the vineyards were collectivized, and it's taken a long time for them to... You can't make good wine by applying industrial methods to it, but the vineyards are being replanted in Transylvania right now, and they're actually making some unbelievably beautiful wines, and the basic climate is very similar to what you find in Germany, so as are the soil types. So Rieslings are excellent. They also make some very nice red wines. And insofar as the little shots that they serve at the end of the meal to make sure you sleep well that night, everybody's got a still in their backyard. I think you could, you know, what you could drink caraway brandy, but they probably make it out of old tires, too, for all I know.
I bet they do. You talk about, as a cheese lover, you know, I'm always interested. In fact, my trip to the region was to search out a cheese that I had read about called Trachis, which somebody was telling me was the kind of the origin of yogurt coming across the Danube and coming across Romania into the mountains of Bulgaria. And so I was out on a search to try to better understand the yogurts of Bulgaria and the drain yogurts and understand, again, the fetas and the kashkavals and these kind of cheeses, because I have a little cheese plant here in Louisiana where I, again, was doing triple creams and things like that. And I saw cheese everywhere, cheese used on everything, cheese put in ways I never dreamed of. Did you find the same thing to be true in that whole region about just the homemade cheeses and just the use of milk in so many different ways in cooking?
There's a lot of cheese in Romania, but the cheeses come from different spokes of that kitchen, because the Romanians themselves, they still... During the summer, and this was something that was very interesting when I was last there, they still bring their herds up to the mountain pastures. You know, they call it in French, they call it the transhumance, and it's the idea that you take your animals up to up on the mountainside to profit from the pastures. And almost every village had shepherds. People would give the shepherds their animals. They'd take them up on the mountain. I was there during that time.
Wow.
And the shepherds make the cheese up on the mountains, and what they do... Mostly sheep cheeses there. The cow's milk cheeses were usually found in the German villages, but there's a lot of sheep's milk cheese. And what they do is the shepherds would make the cheese, and either they'd send it back down to the villages fresh, so that it was more of a curdy type cheese, nice tangy cheese, or they'd keep them up there and age them a little bit, and so that they'd be something to eat during the winter.
Well, I can taste it already because I'm seeing everything he just talked about.
Well, and Alec, in your article, you even mentioned the summer sheepfold where 600 sheep were milked by hand three times
a
day.
Wow, my God, I can't believe it.
That's a lot of milk.
Well, you know, another interesting thing when I was there is that Romania is now part of the European Union. And one of the most interesting conversations I had when we went, a friend of mine and I, when we were staying at the little village where we rented the house, I said to her, I said, we can't just show up, drop out of the sky like two Americans and rent a house in a village with 500 people. We should go introduce ourselves to the mayors. So we did. And he'd worked in a car factory in Germany for a long time, and I speak very bad German. Between that and a lot of caraway brandy, we didn't understand each other. And I told him what we were doing there. And I said to him, too, I said, you know, your food would fetch premium prices in big cities like London or Paris or Berlin, because your food is what we call organic. And, you know, they don't even think of it that way because their food is clean and pure and no preservatives, none of that stuff. And I said, before the European Union drops on your shoulders with their industrial regulations, you should defend yourselves here, because you're making absolutely beautiful foods. And the European Union, when I was last there, the countryside was being traced with little trucks going around visiting the farms and trying to explain to the farmers what they were doing, quote, wrong. And this was causing a great deal of consternation and head scratching because they were trying to, quote, bring their standards up to European standards. Which, you know, the poor Romanians were completely befuddled. They didn't have the money to spend on the the machinery, and B, as far as they were concerned, they've been eating this way for centuries, and it had worked out just fine.
Oh, my God, what a crime to start trying to change that beautiful, beautiful history of food in these areas. Ali, can you do us a favor and stay with us just for a minute? We're going to go to a quick commercial, and I promise we'll let you go. We'll let you go quickly after.
He's got to eat New York.
I know. You're fascinating, and we're talking about everything that we love and you love here, so we appreciate you. We'll be back in just a minute.
Wouldn't you like to see something strange? Come with us and you will see. This is our town of Halloween.
This is Halloween, this is Halloween.
Pumpkins scream in the dead of night.
This is Halloween, everybody make a scene.
Trick or treat till the neighbor's gonna die.
Public Radio for Acadiana. KRVS 88.7 FM. Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Chances are you spend a lot of time listening to KRVS during the week. And chances are the value you get from KRVS reaches far beyond just the hours you spend listening. Think about the music in your CD library and on your iPod. The live performances you see and the music you share with friends over dinner and great conversation. KRVS helps you make connections that enrich your life. Listener support keeps KRVS connected to you. Please give generously today to keep that connection strong. Call during the day or go to KRVS.org to pledge securely.
Hi, this is Bill Bowens from The Dirty Rice Show, inviting you to join either Mr. Lee Klein, Peter, or myself every Saturday night from 8:30 p.m. until 10 p.m. for Dirty Rice right here on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, public radio for Acadiana.
Greetings. Move to KRVS every Sunday night for 2 hours of hardcore classic Rasta reggae radio right here on Jamon. Jamon, Sunday nights 9 to 11 p.m., Saturday mornings 1 to 3 here on KRVS, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Mania. If not, then let me explain ya. Yes, sir. It's the Transylvania Mania. Whether you're in Ruritania or a dance hall in Albania, yes, sir. It's the Transylvania Mania.
You're getting there.
Thanks, Jeff.
Michelle, I have to read something to you.
Okay.
Past a gate in a wall just wide enough for a hay cart, the sweet smell of wood smoke filled the air of the Bardas' narrow plot. Marina Bardas showed off her hen house, pig pen, and vegetable garden planted with potatoes, beans, peppers, tomatoes, cabbage, carrots, corn, and onions. Then she swept away the ashes from her wood-burning oven with green elder switches and loaded it with 6 big rounds of wheat flour dough, enough to feed a family for 2 weeks. I was fascinated to see that she deliberately let the loaves bake past the point when another baker in another place might have considered them burnt. I could just read this for another hour to figure out where it's going, because I just want to be there in person. Alec, you're a genius. My God, I love your writing.
You know? Thank you so much.
So what happened with the bread?
That's, I wanted to stop it there. I wanted everybody to get his books.
Well, you obviously ate a lot of food, and one of the things that you said was that those who prepared the meals in the country inns where you stayed cooked just as they cooked at home. And one of them mentioned eggs pickled in cabbage juice. So did you ever have that?
Oh, we did try that. We tried that in the guest house that we were staying in. That was one of the nicest places to stay. That's mentioned in the piece. It was a Hungarian count who had actually grown up in Germany and in the United States. And as soon as the country, Romania, became free again, he decided that he wanted to go home and take back the family properties. And he was a really smart, nice man. And he said, you know, we weren't just going to show up and take our properties back. We wanted to involve the village with our project. And our project was to bring people from outside of Romania closer to our way of life. And that's why in this particular inn, all of the food was prepared by housewives from the village. And as I think I may have mentioned in the piece, when I went into the kitchen after dinner, the food was unbelievably delicious, and started asking them questions about the recipes. They were absolutely befuddled. They said, well, we just cook. You know, we don't want recipes. What do you mean recipes? We've always done it this way. And the pickled eggs, I mean, cabbage is a very important staple vegetable in Romania. And fermented cabbage is, of course, something that's found in kitchens all over the world, from Korea to Germany, what have you. And basically, the cabbage juice is almost like what you'd find after you've made sauerkraut, and was a way of preserving food. I mean, there were certain ways of preserving food, smoking, salting, and pickling. And that was the whole idea of the pickled eggs, which you can also find in pubs in England.
And throughout many of the back country roads of Louisiana, the big jars of the pickled eggs everywhere. We're often asked, and I know you must be as well, why do we do the things we do? Why do we go to the places we go? Why do we go to the far end reaches of the earth when you could just stay in Paris or you could stay in New York, and to trek out into these unique, just time-honored, traditional places that have never changed? What's your answer to that? What motivates people to go and experience these pieces of history that are just so quickly and unfortunately just fading away, I think? What's the motivation? What makes you you move in this realm?
Well, I think the fastest, happiest, and gentlest way to approach another culture is through its food. And I had a grandmother who always said that I was born with a stone in my shoe, by which she meant that I was restless and curious. And I always remember one day on a beach in Connecticut, where I grew up, it was a very clear day, and you could see across Long Island Sound to Long Island. And some lady said to me, someday maybe, you know, when you're grown up, you'll go to the other side of Long Island Sound and visit Long Island. And I said, according to my mother, well, that would be fine, but Long Island, and then I'll keep going. And that's just what I did. Even though I've lived in Paris for 27 years, I would also say another interesting thing about living overseas for a long time is that it makes you very proud to be an American, and it also gives you a very deep understanding of what our country is. And my curiosity is as insatiable as my appetite. I guess that's the best way to put it.
Well, I guess my quick connection with you after reading through some of your things in preparation for the show, I'm pretty much the same way, in being of German descent myself and our family arriving in Louisiana in the 1720s. You know, I had that drive myself to experience the unknown. I opened a restaurant in Moscow in 1988 for the Reagan-Gorbachev summit, and was so fascinated with this land. I mean, it just was not open at that point. It was when glasnost was first talked about and perestroika was first mentioned in the West. I went to China to open a restaurant in Beijing and to experience it, and I didn't want to leave. I mean, it was so unique and so different and just so unbelievably different from anything I had ever seen, and the foods were just... I would just stand in the marketplace and watch the Chinese bake sweet potatoes in a wooden fire in a barrel with lines of people standing there to get one. And I said, my God, this is just incredible stuff. And to read your pieces, it makes me realize how just great it is to have those experiences and to keep on just dreaming to have more of them. And you bring them to life through your words. So we compliment you on that, and we thank you so much for the work you put into sharing your experiences like this, because it motivated us to say, we have to talk. We have to get in touch with this guy and not forget to get in touch with you a year later. I want to close the show today by saying I understand that you have a portrait of a certain pirate ancestor hanging in your Paris apartment that connects you definitely to Louisiana. My first restaurant was named after this pirate. My corporation is named after Jean Lafitte. And another connection you and I have. Share the story with us if you would. I know you mentioned it a little earlier, but the Lafitte connection, is it a relation?
It is a relation. The portrait, the oil painting, a beautiful oil painting that I have in Paris, has come down through, it's always given to the firstborn son, although I think I'm going to be leaving it to a very beautiful niece. And the pirate, whose name was Jacinto Lobrano, had a, after he became respectable and settled down and had a sugar plantation and various other things, had portraits done of him and his wife. His wife's name was Marie-Adeline Romain, and that painting, the twin painting, is, to the best of my knowledge, is in the Museum of the City of New Orleans. And the, so I have the pirate in Paris, and his wife is in New Orleans, and it's an absolutely beautiful early American painting that my mom had restored at the art school at Yale some years back, and they said it was a very unusual painting because it was not painted by an itinerant painter. It was a real portrait. And the pirate has a ring in his ear and a diamond lavalier, and he looks like someone you don't want to mess with.
Well, I long to see it at some point in time because I remember the trouble we had trying to get the likeness of Jean Lafitte when I wanted to do a painting of Jean Lafitte because it was just so hard to find it, and it just so happened that there was a little charcoal done by another of his pirates that just happened to be in the Louisiana collection, I think, and we found it there, and I was able to do all of the portraits necessary for our company for Jean Lafitte. So it's what a treasure you have with another of his pirates hanging in your Paris apartment. So anyway, Alec, thanks so much for the time you spent with us today. We will make sure that all of the information today on the books coming out, will be on our website, everybody, jfalls.com. Just go to Starting It Up, jfalls.com, and you'll get all of the information. We do sincerely look forward to hosting you whenever you come to New Orleans. We have some unbelievable things we'd love to share with you here and have you on the show again. So thanks so much for being with us.
It's been a big pleasure, and I just wish I had one of those sweet potatoes you described in Beijing in my kitchen here in New York.
Let me tell you, I still remember the taste absolutely as if I was eating it right now. I'll never forget it.
But, I envy you.
Anyway, thanks so much. Look so forward to shaking your hand. So thanks so
you
much.
Thanks,
Alec.
Now, y'all, we're going to jump into Michelle. Do you have any other than the books on the subject we talked about just now?
Yeah, actually, I do. From the culinary angle, the first book that I want to recommend is entitled Cooking Around the World, Romanian, Bulgarian, and Balkan. It was written by Trish Davies. As part of her Cooking Around the World series, she gives a culinary tour of Southeastern and Eastern European cuisine, with each chapter covering a different country. So, reading through the introductions to each chapter, you get a really good sense of place that correlates with history and the food and the culture. You know, Balkan cuisine, as you mentioned earlier, really isn't familiar to a lot of us, but her book really walks you through the cooking processes, walks you through the foods that are unique in the region, and kind of takes away the foreign element that we feel a lot of times toward this food culture.
Right.
The second book, it's a self-published book, interestingly, from a Romanian about Romania. It's called The Complete Insider's Guide to Romania 2013. It was written by Sam R. That's it, R. Mr. R. wanted to give some first-hand knowledge of his home, the customs, the food, the culture, for anybody who wanted to visit. In the movie Dracula, Count Dracul said to a visitor to his castle, "There shall be to you many strange things." But this book kind of helps you figure them out. So it's a great review of the area. And then, of course, if you don't already have a copy of In Search of Dracula, A True History of Dracula and Vampire Legends by Raymond T. McNally and Radu Florescu, that's not a bad one to have on your shelves as well.
Well, it sounds great, and we'll have all of that information on the website as well. And Dean, what about Facebook? Anything going on Facebook?
Our Facebook page, facebook.com/stirringitupradio, and that's without a G in the stirring. And that's our public forum for all our stovehounds. If you're a stovehound, then you know what that means. But if you're listening to this show, then you might just well be considered a stovehound yourself.
That's exactly right. And you can go there and get all of that and share experiences with us, y'all, or at least tell us what you're interested in hearing. We're always interested in answering your request for shows as well. So, y'all, I got to cook a little bit, too, because we're talking about Romanian. We're talking about all of that. I mean,
Hungarian.
There's like goulash, you know, which, by the way, goulash is the Hungarian word for herdsman. This goulash kind of resembles most of these simple stew-like dishes mm-hmm. cooked by herdsmen who are working the sheep there in the countryside. There's vegetable versions. Mm-hmm. You can put wild game in them, a lamb, whatever else. So there's, I have a good goulash recipe. I have a good grilled sausage recipe as well. You know, a traditional Romanian dish of a grilled, kind of like meatballs, meat rolls made with mm-hmm. Mixture. I have that. I also have a pork kebab, a peach glaze, you know, from the Middle East, Central Asia does them as well. What do y'all feel like? You feel like goulash or sausages or pork kebabs, huh?
I like those grilled sausages, too.
Well, since it's Romanian, maybe we ought to go there. We are going to have the recipes on the website,
People
can go and get them all. Yeah, let's do the sausages, because metele, I think they call it metele. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right. That's Romanian. But
I can't quite help you.
But anyway, it means grilled sausages. I'm not sure it means Romanian grilled sausage, but that's the source of it. It only takes about an hour to do it, 6 to 8 servings. And it's a traditional Romanian dish, as I mentioned, of grilled ground meat, almost like meatballs. I guess you can put them in patties. But the unique thing about it is that it can be made from a mixture of beef, lamb, pork, and all the spices. So you'll see it a lot of times used, as we do in Louisiana, to use a combination of meats mm-hmm. and things just to kind of make use of a lot of the things you have. And these herdsmen, of course, are raising beef and lamb and pork and sheep. So there's always a need to use up the product. But I'm going to make it with pork. We love pork here. So I'm using 2 pounds of ground pork, 2 tablespoons of olive oil plus for brushing. And in a medium bowl, I'm going to combine all of these things. I'm going to combine the 2 pounds of pork, 2 tablespoons of hot paprika, very Romanian, mm-hmm. 1 tablespoon of kosher salt, 2 teaspoons of dried thyme leaves. And here's that caraway. You have to have mm-hmm. caraway from that region. 2 teaspoons. Caraway can be a little herb, let me put it that way. So you want to be careful. So you might want to start with 1 teaspoon and see how it tastes. And the caraway seeds can be crushed. 2 teaspoons of fresh ground pepper. It's Romanian food. It's hot. So you have 1.5 teaspoons of crushed red pepper flakes. Always a nice little spice. And Michelle, the reason I love this sausage, 9 to 10 cloves of crushed garlic peeled and minced after you crush it.
That's to keep the vampires away,
right? That's exactly right. That's why you need it. Anyway, y'all, you're going to combine all of that, and you're going to, once it's all well mixed with all of that, you're going to form it into a 20 by, 22-inch, 3/4-inch link. You're going to roll one long roll that's going to be about 2 feet long. Mm-hmm. You're going to do it that way. Then you're going to just set it aside and over a medium-high heat, you're going to brush the cast iron skillet with that oil I'm talking about. Then, working in batches, you're going to turn these sausages. After you cut the long roll, you're going to cut it in 2-inch lengths, and you're going to form it into little round, almost like little, little tamales, almost little sausages uh-huh. about 2 inches long. And you're going to put them in there, and you're going to just keep turning them around until they're nice and golden brown. You can finish them in the oven if you want at 350 degrees. Just throw them in there, but you want to brown them in that skillet first from the outside. So again, once you mix all the ingredients, you just kind of roll it jelly roll style across the table into about a two-foot-long piece, and then you just cut it into this. They like them like little meatballs, about 3/4 inch. I like them about 2 inches. Mm-hmm. Then you just brown them in that skillet, and the caraway and all of that's going to really give it good flavor.
Sounds really delicious.
Y'all, the recipes on the website, all of them are. We thank you so much for being here, and y'all remember, Halloween's right around the corner. Be safe, and don't do, kids, what we did. Do not steal people's satsumas. That's what we did. Stay away from them. All right, y'all, we'll see you next week, and be safe out there.